I'm joined in the studio by Gilbert Achecard. Gilbert is a professor at the University of Paris. He teaches politics and international relations. He's also a frequent contributor to Le Monde Diplomatique, and he's authored several books. His most current book is out in English, published by Monthly Review Press, and it's titled The Clash of Barbarisms, September 11th, and the Making of a New World Disordered. Gilbert Achecard, welcome to KPFA.
Thank you.
Maybe we need to explain which are the barbarisms that you view as clashing currently, and is September 11th a founding event or just one of many events along this this barbaristic path here?
Well, speaking of a clash of barbarisms, I mean, on the one side, I mean, the barbarian character of 9/11 and of those who perpetrated such a mass murder is, I think, quite obvious. But I believe that it should be obvious in the same way that these are reactions to another kind of barbarism, which is implemented by the dominant powers on the global level, and mainly by the United States. I mean, this has been linked to the key choices of the United States successive administrations after the end of the Cold War. And if you look at things from the Middle East, I mean, the reasons for the resentment toward the United States and that part of the world, and this hatred which leads people, young people, to be ready even to commit suicide in order to kill Americans, is to be found in the kind of policies that practiced by the U.S. government there.
Well, during the Cold War, the rationale for any number of different U.S. Diplomatic activities was that we have to make friends with these dictatorial countries because it's a chess game. We're fighting the Soviet Union. Certainly, we're going to have to make compromises and look the other way if some of our allies happen to be human rights violators and subjecting their own people to horrible deprivations. That was the rationale during the Cold War, but when the Cold War ended, those rationales didn't cease. They just sort of morphed into something else.
No, we're still in the same kind of attitude, basically. That is, anyone who would believe that Washington is fighting for democracy all over the world would be completely misled. I mean, the reality is that the United States fight any kind of government, whether democratic or dictatorial, which is not palatable to their interests, their vital interests as they consider. Like, for instance, I mean, in the same way that they are fighting for the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, who is undoubtedly a dictator, they are also trying to overthrow Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, who is undoubtedly someone who has been elected through democratic elections. And the reverse is also true. That is, among the friends of the United States, among the allies of the United States, you still have a lot of despotic regimes all over the world, and mainly in the Middle East, actually. The large majority of Arab governments and even governments in the Muslim world are despotic governments, but it so happens also that the large majority of them, the vast majority of them, are close allies of Washington. And we can start with, the oldest ally of Washington in that part of the world, which is the Saudi Kingdom, which has been for decades and decades an ally of the United States and is by far the most undemocratic, the most oppressive of women, and the most fundamentalist state that there is on this earth.
You point out in your book, The Clash of Barbarisms, that you go into some detail writing about Osama bin Laden, that in fact Osama's fight is largely with the Saudi royal family, and of course he is Saudi himself, and but he realizes that you can't get at the Saudi royal family without getting at the U.S.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's, I think this is a very obvious truth anyhow in the Middle East. I mean, everyone knows that the Saudi ruling family actually lives through the protection provided by the United States. The United States have been the guarantors of the security of this regime, this royalist regime since you have had the alliance between the two countries then, which goes back to the 30s and 40s. And therefore, I mean, as you know, Osama bin Laden used to be a close collaborator of the Saudi government, and the U.S. agencies in the war against the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. And he turned completely against the United States after the United States decided to maintain troops on Saudi territory after the previous Gulf War of 1990-91. That was the main reason which turned him against the both the United States and his government, which he came to consider as purely under U.S. control.
Well, going back historically, back to the clash of barbarisms, the U.S. Usually tried to make a point that it was not in a colonial government. It was not an imperial government. It didn't, as the British or the French, have colonies all over the world. And following World War II, there was even some noise that the U.S. was not going to spend its money or military for the purpose of shoring up the British Empire or the French Empire. So this, I think it, even people like Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam thought that the United States was serious in being an advocate for the decolonization of Africa, of Southeast Asia, South Asia, etc. And I think the United States got a good deal of positive PR from that. Do you think that was sincere at the time, or was it just PR?
I mean, that was linked to the fact that the United States, historically speaking, is a latecomer in the race for the imperial division of the world. And therefore, as a latecomer, the most convenient policy for the United States was to denounce traditional colonialism, because the United States was mainly looking for establishing some different kind of domination through, I mean, what has been labeled neocolonialism, or let's say informal type of imperial domination, because you've got two types of empires. You have formal empires and you have informal empires, and the U.S. empire is an informal one. It has been mainly so, I mean, for a few exceptions, but it has mainly been built as an informal empire. But nevertheless, the domination, the hegemony exerted by the United States is no less, real than what you've got even in formal colonies.
My guest is Gilbert Achgar. His book is titled The Clash of Barbarism, September 11th, and the Making of a New World Disorder. It's put out by Monthly Review Press. So, again, the Soviet Union collapsed in 91, no more Cold War, and in fact, the Soviet Union then became Russian Federation, demonstrated that though it had maybe 10,000 nuclear weapons, it was really not a world leader economically or in any other way. This sort of boosted the prestige of the U.S. as the sole remaining superpower, both with its military clout and also with its economic clout. So how powerful is the United States worldwide? And is the power, again, economic or military or both?
Well, the main power of the United States in terms of relative power compared with the other powers that exist in this world is military. I mean, this is the main tool for U.S. supremacy. obviously, I mean, the U.S. has a very large economy, and it's also an economic power. That's absolutely obvious. But I would say that the main advantage that the United States has over its partners and rivals is in the military field. And that was the key option of the successive administrations in this country after the end of the Cold War, after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Their main option was to maintain this military supremacy, and that has been given a kind of priority, which translates in the fact that nowadays the United States are spending alone 40% of world military expenditure, and is on its way through the increase in the military budget to reaching a point where the United States will be spending as much as the rest of the world. And that could be, I mean, before or around the end of this decade, we could reach a point where the United States will be spending 50%, that is as much as 190 plus states all over the world. I mean, that's an absolutely incredible situation. And if you compare that to the fact that the United States is, and by far, among rich industrial countries, the country which spends the smallest percentage of its national product for public aid for development, that is less than 0.1% of GNP, of the gross national product. I mean, in the comparison between these two facts, these two figures, you get the essence of the key options of the successive administrations in the U.S. after the Cold War. And actually, that's, I mean, I think the main aspect of what I call barbarism in that regard. That is, we have been witnessing a real regression toward barbarism, a real descent into barbarism since the end of the Cold War, against all the hopes and expectations that the end of the Cold War had raised. I mean, you remember, I mean, people were dreaming about, you know, a different world, the rule of law, collective institutions, United Nations, peace dividend recycled into the economic aid, etc. I mean, that was the expectation of so many people. And what we've got is completely different. It's the law of the jungle more than ever, the law of the strongest. The United States is behaving, you know, as a completely arrogant supremacist power.
Gilbert, you have in your book a quote from George Bush, the father, dated September 11th, 1990. So this is shortly after Iraq invaded Kuwait, like a month after Iraq invaded Kuwait. And I'm not sure who he was speaking to. It was clearly at a time prior to the collapse of the Soviet Union, but clearly the Soviet Union was probably not going to be a rival of the U.S. anymore. And this is what George Herbert Walker Bush had to say back then in September 1990. A new era, freer from the threat of terror, stronger in the pursuit of justice, and more secure in the quest for peace. An era in which the nations of the world, east and west, north and south, can prosper and live in harmony. A world where the rule of law supplants the rule of the jungle. A world in which nations recognize the shared responsibility for freedom and justice. A world where the strong respect the rights of the weak.
Yeah, that should go down the record, you know, the book of record of the hypocritical speech. Because if you look at what we've got under his son, it's exactly the contrary. Exactly the contrary. I mean, the sentence you read could be reversed bit by bit, and you get exactly the picture of what we are in. That is the law of the jungle, this priority to military expenditure, and a government which is going even further than what you've got already since Ronald Reagan in dismantling social gains, in dismantling social security, in all this deregulation, privatization, and the rest of the neoliberal, neoconservative agenda. And that's a key aspect of this barbarism.
If in fact, well, briefly tell me what the Clinton folks had to say. Were they as equally into ruling the world as a hegemonic force as the Bushes?
Well, I mean, the key choices of the, I mean, concerning the post-Cold War world were made under the Clinton administration. And that's where they had to, I mean, because it so happens that Clinton came to power in the 90s. That is the main period. And at that time, the administration was using a lot, you know, the formula, and still using, actually, in the official documents, the formula of shaping the world. And so, I mean, they had to make some choices. And these choices were, I would say, consistent at the international level, at the foreign policy level, with the fact that Clinton represented at the level of the Democrats some kind of, you know, continuation of more than discontinuity with the Reagan years in terms of social agenda. There was, I mean, he was dedicated to the neoliberal, neoconservative agenda in terms, I mean, which he did not really challenge or reverse. And that's, I mean, I think the fact that the option that I described, that is the rise of the military, the increase in the military budget, is linked of the same kind of framework, and it started before George W. Bush. It is under Clinton since 1998-99 that the trend toward the reduction of the military budget was reversed. I mean, the post-Cold War trend, and there was the start of a new long-term increase in the military budget.
You have to admit that the rhetoric of the Clinton administration toward allies and rivals around the world was certainly very toned down compared to the rhetoric of this Bush administration.
Oh, definitely. I mean, there's at the same time, there's some continuity between the key choices, the key options, from the previous administration and this one, and there is a discontinuity. There are differences, obviously, in the style, in the tone, in the way they address the rest of the world, and especially the close partners of the United States, that is mainly Western Europe and Japan, but mainly Western Europe is concerned here. And, well, this difference is what also explains the fact that Bush has been so arrogant that he managed to destroy some part of the image that the United States had built, you know, as a world leader in the previous years.
Is it as blatant as the Bush administration is using the military clout of the United States of America for the purpose of grabbing the wealth of the planet for U.S. corporations to the exclusion of everybody else? Is it that flat out just a grab for money and power?
Well, yeah, absolutely, a grab for money and power. Well, there's a grab for power, which translates into military strategies and I mean, what we have been going through in the after 9/11 has been the final stage, you know, of this kind of network, global network of military bases and alliances covering the whole planet, which is led by the United States. The final stage being the fact that the United States seized the opportunity of the war in Afghanistan to build military bases in former Soviet Central Asia, in a very strategic location, which is between Russia and China, the two countries which are considered in Washington as potential rivals for U.S. hegemony. So, I mean, this is this has been at the level of military, the level of power, and economically speaking, if I mean, we cannot understand a key aspect of the foreign policy, especially of this administration, if, for instance, we don't understand that it's linked to oil interests. If you just look at it, I mean, the war in Afghanistan, as I said, was seized as an opportunity to establish a military basis in Central Asia and to send troops as far as Georgia, that's in the Caucasus, and that's I mean, this is in the Caspian Sea area, Caspian Sea Basin, which is one of the most promising areas in terms of potential for increasing the oil production there. These military bases are the insurance that or the guarantee that U.S. oil companies, which were present there ever since the Soviet Union collapsed, the U.S. oil companies were expecting. They needed some kind of protection, some kind of guarantee in order to invest in that part of the world. And then you have the coming war, against Iraq being the second largest holder of oil reserves in the world. If you look at, for instance, the priorities of this administration in Latin America, we see the increasing involvement in Colombia, which is centered around the oil-producing area of Colombia and the pipeline area of Colombia. And we see those repeated attempts at overthrowing Hugo Chavez, which are obviously linked to the status of Venezuela as a major oil producer. So, there's obviously a major rationale here for the foreign policy of this administration.
Gilbert Achecar is my guest. The name of his book, The Clash of Barbarisms, September 11th, and the Making of a New World Disorder, put out by Monthly Review Press. The British and French governments currently are holding their ground against the U.S. Effort to go to war.
You mean German and French?
What did I say?
British.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, thank you for correcting me. The French and the German governments are holding their ground. Are they doing this because they somehow have integrity, or is there some other motivation here?
No, I really don't believe at all in the purity of intentions of these two governments. Because if it was a matter of principle, they would have taken that kind of stand long ago. But they have been participating in every kind of military adventure of the United States over the past years. And if presently they are taking the stand they are taking, it is for reasons which are not reasons of principle, but I would say very opportunistic reasons. On the side of the French government, and I mean, you can be sure that the vast majority of those who demonstrated recently on February 15 in the streets of Paris and the rest of and other French cities are completely convinced of that. They know that Jacques Chirac's position is also rooted in oil interests. It's because Saddam Hussein has granted French and Russian oil companies major concessions in Iraq during the 90s in order to provide them with an incentive for having them work at the Security Council, the UN Security Council, in order to lift the embargo which is imposed on Iraq. And what Jacques Chirac would like, the same applies to the Russian government, is to be able to maintain Saddam Hussein in power and the contracts with him. Whereas Washington wants to overthrow the regime there, not because this regime is dictatorial or anything of the kind, but because they want to overthrow him and to cancel the contracts he's done with Russian and French oil companies. So if we point to that, I mean, we should also remember that Vladimir Putin is in the same category of those objecting to this war. So I'm sure you won't label Vladimir Putin as a pacifist.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Gilbert Achecar, professor of politics and international relations at University of Paris and author of The Clash of Barbarism, September 11th, and the Making of the New World Disorder, published by Monthly Review Press. You can read more about it at the Monthly Review website, www.monthlyreview.org, or you can call their 800 number, 1-800-670-9499. 1-800-670-9499. Gilbert, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.